Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host Eddie Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New every Thursday on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to subscribe so you do not miss an episode. And thank you for listening. And don't forget, everything you hear on the Eddie Trunk Podcast originated on my radio show, which is called Trunk Nation, and heard live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern, on Faction Talk, Sirius XM Channel 103, or anytime, full shows on the Sirius XM app. If you're only listening to the podcast and you can get Sirius XM Radio, you're only getting a tiny fraction of what I do each and every day. Come on board and join us, and I got a way for you to sample it if you'd like. Totally free. All you got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunk. You can get a free 3-month trial subscription to SiriusXM, and it will not require a credit card for you to sign up. And you can listen and sample for 3 months, whether it be through the app or over the radio. And we'd love for you to do that so you can get a full picture of everything going on the radio each and every day. And again, it'll cost you nothing. You get 3 months free to check it out. So again, SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunk. We have this week on the podcast an interview that I did about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It is with legendary songwriter Desmond Child, a guy that has been behind the scenes as a co-writer on some of the biggest songs in rock music and pop music for that matter. Desmond started his career as a songwriter working with other people all the way back in 1979 when he co-wrote the big Kiss disco hit, I Was Made for Loving You, and did a bunch of stuff for Kiss and Alice Cooper and huge songs for Bon Jovi like Living on a Prayer and others, some Aerosmith stuff. Desmond has a book out about his life and his career. We talk about that book. We talk about some of his story and the art of writing hit songs with him. I think you're going to really enjoy it. So with that being said, let's get right to it. My interview with songwriter Desmond Child this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Desmond, how are you?
Eddie, how you doing? It's so great to be back.
Yeah, I was just saying it probably was a couple years ago that we chatted and had a great conversation. I think at that time you had mentioned you were working on a book, and here it is. It's out.
Yeah, it's been 7 years working on the book. I call it my 7-year jailhouse confession. It was a real reckoning. I didn't know what I was getting into, actually. But once I started telling my story, all of these memories started coming out and I started to see, wow, I've been through a lot. And you see it reflected in the songs that I helped to collaborate on.
Yeah, what's the big difference between writing a book versus writing a song?
A song is like 4 minutes long. Right. And writing a book is, wow, you know, I just got finished doing the audiobook, and that took me like a month and a half to do. I mean, it was worse than writing it, because when you say it, then you get all choked up, you know? And so I'm still working on that. But the thing is that when I look, you know, across, you know, the breadth of, you know, length and breadth of my life, you know, I've been extraordinarily lucky, amazing mentors and people that opened doors for me, like Paul Stanley of Kiss. He was the one that discovered me and gave my name to John Bon Jovi, who called me, and then, you know, we wrote, you know, You Give Love a Bad Name the very first day with Richie Sambora, and Living on a Prayer, and then Aerosmith, Dude Looks Like a Lady, What It Takes, Crazy, Angel. You know, it was like I really stepped into a magical world, and it's all because of my mentor, Paul Stanley of Kiss.
Who actually wrote a beautiful foreword for the book. I guess he was the no-brainer to go to, given what you just said, especially to be the guy to write the foreword.
Yes, I mean, I say it in the book. He taught me how to write, you know, stadium anthems the Kiss way, you know, which is the protagonist always has to be the victor. There can never be the loser. And so that kind of feeling of upward, you know, hope, is something that I think you can feel like that thread going through songs like Living on a Prayer, you know, just that joy and that reaching up. That's all because of Kiss. There would be no Desmond Child without Paul Stanley.
Yeah, I mean, that's really amazing, that part of the story. Now, Desmond, just in full disclosure, and I told the publicist this, I have not had a chance to read the book because of my schedule. I have it right here. I can't wait to read it. But I know the book just came out, and they wanted to have you on to promote it in release week. So I totally get that. But maybe down the line, I might be hitting you up to do another round, because I'm sure after I read this, I'm going to want to dig in so much more on the stories in here. But, you know, I know enough about your work to talk to you, and I want to let people know the book is out now. I just, in all honesty, I can't wait to read it. I just have not had the time, but I look forward to doing so. So I'm sure there's stuff in here that I'm going to want to ask you about again down the line.
Well, I wanted to make sure I didn't write a book like, and then I did, and then I succeeded, and this is the award I got. And I mean, you know, those books, you know, you just want to throw them in the garbage, you know, after 10 pages. I wanted a book that really showed, you know, an American story, you know, being, you know, my mother was Cuban. We lived in the Cuban exile community in Miami, in the projects of Miami and Liberty City. And, you know, my mother was a songwriter. Her name was Elena Casals, known as La Musa. And I just wanted to make sure I could take care of my mother. And so I worked hard, you know, like the hustle was big, you know, to try to make sure that I succeeded so I could take care of her. I mean, she always dreamed of having a mansion on Miami Beach. Well, you know what? I bought four and I gave her one. How's that?
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I want to go back to something like, so for people that don't know your whole story, and of course, myself being in the music industry 40 years, of course, I know all the stuff you've done and the people you've worked with and the arc of your story just through the business. But for people that don't know, you started out as a performer yourself, and you had a band and an album called Desmond Child and Rouge. And that's actually, and I did glance through the book a little bit. I did read that in Paul's foreword, he says that he's basically in 77 or something, walking through New York City. He sees a poster for the band playing in New York City. He was interested in the band, the look of the band, the dynamic. He goes to see you, and that's where the whole thing happens. Can you take us through that? Because that's a really kind of pivotal point there, and I find it really interesting with songwriters, and I've interviewed many of them, where there's a pivotal point where they go from being the person on the stage, the person performing, the person trying to quote unquote make it. But then there's this shift and they kind of like, wait a minute, there's another way to do this. I'm going to be the, for lack of a better term, and I know this is mentioned in the book, song doctor, or I'm going to be the person helping to write the songs, where you're going to have some anonymity, but you're also going to have great success. So that, to me, that's always a pivotal point, and you kind of did that, right? Because you initially wanted to be the person out front, right?
Well, you know, I wanted to be the biggest star on earth, like a rock star. And, you know, we were getting there, but then, you know, our group fell apart. And, you know, it was one of those things where I could never get back in the saddle, you know. So by default, the day I met Paul Stanley, the night I met Paul Stanley, he had come to a little club called Trax, which was on 72nd Street, literally underground. You had to go down this deep little staircase. And he poked his head around the corner of the curtain. We were standing there getting ready to go on. He said, "Hey, I'm Paul Stanley of Kiss. I just wanted you guys to know that George Harrison of the Beatles is in the front table." It was like, gulp. And so I looked, and
really?
Sure enough, there he was. And so we got to sing for one of the Beatles. What about that? And so then after the show, he came back and he said, "I really like your sound. Why don't we try writing a song together?" So he wrote a song with me for Desmond Child and Rouge called "The Fight," which was on our first record. And then he said, "Okay, well, let's write a song for my band." Okay. And we wrote "I Was Made for Loving You." And I think I got the better end of that deal. What do you think?
Well, did the fight? Now, that was an interesting thing too, because I wasn't aware of "The Fight," and I know that you said that was on the record. So nothing, that song didn't become a hit, obviously.
No, I mean, our album, you know, we sold, you know, maybe, you know, in those days, if you sold 200,000 records, it was a complete failure.
Right.
You know, and so that was the turning point in history musically, where we went from having disco and R&B music and all of that. Suddenly, there was this DJ that, you know, started riling people up and saying, you know, disco is gay, disco is black, you know, what we want is white music, rock and roll, rock music. And so, you know, he had these events where people brought their disco records and threw them in a pile and they burned them. Sound familiar? And then,
well, that was in Chicago. That was the big thing in Chicago, where that was that big incident with I forget, Steve Dahl, I think, was the guy's name, and they did the thing during a baseball game or something.
Yeah, I mean, the Nazis did it, and now they're doing it again. You know, the same kind of swing the other way. And, you know, so I just shifted to rock. And so we made another record really fast, and it came out the same year, 1979, that was a rock album. And so, you know, all the pressure of everything, we toured the country, we were on Saturday Night Live, we weren't really equipped emotionally to deal with all that, and our group fell apart. So, you know, writing for other people was my B plan. You know, it really was. I mean, A plan was Rockstar, B plan helped to create rock stars. And in the end, I think, you know, looking back, it's like it was meant to be that way. I don't think I would have made a good rock star. I'm so thin-skinned. Well, I mean, really, the people I work with, you know, they get criticized and it just rolls off their back. With me, like, something somebody said 40 years ago is still bugging me, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, that's not, yeah, when you're going to put yourself out there in the public eye, yeah, you can't be that thin skinned. That's not going to work. You know, I'm curious, you know, this pivotal point where Paul Stanley shows up at one of your shows. At that time, Kiss is one of the biggest bands in the world. They're also anonymous, so, you know, nobody really knew what Paul looked like, but he shows up. George Harrison's there, etc. Were you a Kiss fan, and were you aware that the song you co-wrote with Paul for the Dynasty album, "I Was Made for Loving You," 79, becomes and still is a massively popular song? But at the time, were you aware And was there talk about how incredibly polarizing it was going to be, despite the fact that it was a hit, that it for this bombastic hard rock band to come out with a song that sounded like that? Was there any talk about that while you were writing it, or it was being, you know, where you guys were talking about it? Was there any dialogue about that? Like, hey, this is risky to be doing this?
Well, Desmond Child and Rouge had a lot of R&B roots because I came from Miami, the projects of Miami, and we were always listening to R&B music and Motown especially. And Paul is a big fan of Motown. So if you listen to I Was Made for Loving You, you know, I was made for loving you, right? It's sort of like standing in the shadow of love. You know, mm-hmm. It really has that pulse. It really wasn't disco. To us, it was Motown, and we had got it in our minds to create a new kind of format to put hard rock guitars to like a dance beat. You know, it was sort of like revolutionary, because from that moment on, all these people got inspired by that song, and then all of a sudden there was Prince, and all of a sudden there was Michael Jackson doing, you know, Beat It, and there was Madonna, and all these people integrating rock music with pop and dance and all of that. You know, and so I think it was revolutionary for its time. And, you know, we know that Gene Simmons has never liked that song. But, right. I mean, he was in this, they were in this movie called Why Him? They sort of made a cameo appearance. Do you remember that with James Franco? And
no.
So they're like the band in full Kiss regalia is in somebody's living room, like, playing I Was Made for Loving You, and there's Gene with a smile on his face. And I say, I guess the check was big.
Well, it's still in their show, and it's become a song that, like, you know, again, at that time when it came out, I was being a massive Kiss fan as a kid. I remember it was, you know, I was like 14 or something when the song came out. And, you know, I was, look, at that point, anything Kiss threw at me, I was all on board with it. But it was a huge change. And I know Paul's talked about this in his book and everything, where things shifted and it was like a two-edged sword, because it got them on the radio, it became this big song, but it also really alienated a ton of the hardcore fan base. But, you know, what I'm interested about, too, is when you talk about your history there, and we'll talk beyond this in a second, Kiss, on their next record, went, chased that and continued down like a pop, rock, even dance mode on some of that with their follow-up record. But for you, it would be a few albums before you would work with Paul and Kiss again. Later on, you did a lot with them. But why was that? Because you'd think, coming off of a massive hit that you co-wrote in 79, that all of a sudden, next album, you know, every other song would be a Desmond co-write. Why was there a gap there, do you think?
Who knows? Maybe it was Gene's, you know, strong reaction against it, because it wasn't on brand with Kiss,
right,
for him in his mind. Then it sort of like became so in, you know, across, you know, the decades. But, you know, I co-wrote a song with Paul, Heaven's on Fire. And
yeah,
that was another hit for them. So, I mean, Paul and I really enjoyed each other's company. So, you know, we just, you know, kept writing. And so then eventually the songs we wrote started, you know, creeping into the next records they were making. I love a song called Who Wants to Be Lonely.
You know, I do too.
Who Wants to Be Lonely. I just love that song.
Great song.
And,
it's on Asylum.
Yes. And so I think that, you know, I was also extraordinarily busy, because I started getting calls, you know, from bands like Bon Jovi, and who, by the way, Paul gave my number to John and said, you should write with this guy. And so, you know, I owe everything to Paul. I really do. There'd be no Desmond Child without Paul Stanley, that's for sure. And then Aerosmith, and then Alice Cooper, Joan Jett, Cher, Michael Bolton. You know, I had like a very long run, you know, in the 1980s of, you know, hit after hit. There was, at one point, I had 5 songs in the top 20. You know, some were going up, some were going down, but they were all in the top 20. So I was like a wonder child, you know, that I was kind of just putting one foot in front of the other and realized because my group didn't work out that I had to do something so I could make sure that I could take care of my mom. So I just thought, okay, this might not last, but for right now, I'm just going to work and keep working, keep working. You know what? I'm still doing that. I never stop working. You know, I'm still trying. And over the last couple of years, I had a huge hit with Ava Max called Kings and Queens, which was it was 37 weeks at number one on the adult contemporary chart. 37 weeks. I mean, that's Despacito land, right? And, you know, but to me, style is really secondary. What's important is the message. And that's why I've been able to shift, you know, shape shift into whatever group I've been working with. And when I went back to Miami, to Miami Beach, my husband and I decided, you know, we're going to leave California. And that's when I discovered Ricky Martin. And then helped to revolutionize Latin music at that time, because I was wanting to use all that I had learned from Paul Stanley about stadium anthems and put it into Latin music. And we did that, fist in the air, you know, upside, inside out, right? Living la vida loca. You know, it was a turning point that never stopped because it ushered in reggaeton. I mean, you know, Despacito, you know, 20 years later, was one of the biggest songs in the entire world. And so it was amazing to, you know, also when I worked with Bon Jovi, he was coming out of what they call, you know, heavy metal and hair bands and all of that. But the fact is that if you listen to You Give Love a Bad Name and Living on a Prayer, it had that Motown, you know, pumping bass underneath. You know,
baseline, sure.
You know, and so combining R&B in with heavy metal, and then also doing storytelling like a singer songwriter would, instead of, you know, just songs that said she's hot, you know, and saying Living on a Prayer is epic because it tells the story in the third person about a struggling couple that, you know, was trying to make ends meet. But the song is infused with hope. And that is the thing that, you know, you may not believe in God, but you're sunk if you don't believe in hope, right?
True. Yeah. And, you know, when you sang a second ago, Living La Vida Loca, huge hit you co-wrote with Ricky Martin, when you make that comparison, it's really eye-opening because You can see how if that song had been produced with electric guitars all up front, that sort of anthemic chorus absolutely, in my view, would have worked for a hard rock song. It could have been that, like, you know, it really comes down to the way it's produced and the direction you're going to go out with it. But there is a lot of interchangeability there, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, recently a band called Autumn Kings did a version of Living La Vida Loca, all like, you know, really like modern rock, and it sounds awesome, you know, so yeah. People want to check that out. I mean, it's a, you know, that's when you know you have a good song, because it's timeless. And, you know, people, I mean, I've heard jazz versions of my songs, I've heard, you know, electronic, you know, versions, like artsy versions of these same songs. And, you know, it just, you know, you wrote a good song. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, we recently, like last year, we got the Spotify honored Living on a Prayer with saying that we had gotten 1 billion streams.
I saw that.
So if you think about that, you know, how long has Spotify been in business? Like 8 years? Imagine all the other plays that we had before that on radio and in many other ways. You know, I think iTunes, right? All of these innovations that have come along, the songs still hold up. And, you know, one of the things that's happened is like people know the song, they don't necessarily know the artist. Mm-hmm. They, you know, in, you know, some jungle somewhere, somebody knows, you know, I Was Made for Loving You, they don't necessarily have ever even heard the word kiss. But right. That's the power of music, that it can reach deep in, even if the people don't understand the lyrics. You know, it just touches them and makes them have that certain feeling that we had at the point of creation.
Hi, I'm Ariana Maddox. Whether I'm on TV or Broadway, I live by two rules. Follow your dreams and always wear great shoes. That's why I love DSW. Must-have shoes that pair well with whatever you've dreamed up for your life. Seriously, DSW has all the shoes you need for everything, from errand days to date nights. And they're from top brands at prices you can totally brag to all your friends about. That's why I've partnered with DSW to create a collection of shoes I know you'll love. Because, let's be real, whether I'm dancing on TV, teaching you how to make the perfect cocktail in my best selling book, or starting a whole new venture, it's all about the shoes. Find the shoes to do all the amazing things you do in my new collection at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta, because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members, because at Delta, we know.
Refill?
Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
Want to make Mom's Day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat Mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You know, Desmond, having written a song like Living on a Prayer, co-written a song like that, that's over a billion. And it's funny you bring that up, because I just ran down all the rock songs that hit a billion or more on Spotify. And we talked about that on the air just a few days ago, but I'm kind of sitting here laughing because we've all heard about how streaming numbers and the payouts aren't quite there. So, as a co-writer of a song that has streamed over a billion on Spotify alone, did that yield you a check for about $40 or what?
It was like $27.
But it's getting better. It's getting better, right? Is it getting better?
I serve on the board of ASCAP, which is the greatest performance rights collection organization, nonprofit organization. Right. We were just in Washington fighting for songwriters' rights because of AI, because these companies have taken all the music that's on Spotify and YouTube and every which way, and have what they call scraped it into their system without permission, and they're calling that fair use, except that they're selling a subscription to their chat box thing, and it's like we don't have any consent, we don't have any credit, and we don't have any compensation, and so this is dangerous not only for us as songwriters and music creators, but for people that are doing all kinds of other kind of creative things, films, and it just goes on and on. And so it's a very scary thing, because also if kids can just, write their term paper on AI, they didn't really have to learn anything, did they? And so, it's kind of taking the easy way out. And, we have to use our brains in order to stay smart and be competitive in the world for real. So, I'm very passionate about songwriters' rights. And, I see that, the actors have that problem, of, people feeling free to use their images and putting their images and the sound of their voices into other films or television shows without their consent. You know, we don't have to make new laws. We just have to stick with the laws we have that are called copyright, and then everything will be fine. They just have to be, you know, brought into it.
You know, along this line of discussion, I just had the honor of being asked by Dolly Parton to do an interview with her. And I went to Nashville and I sat with her for a couple hours. And this is all going to come out actually in a movie theater for her upcoming record. And we had this great discussion because she made a rock record and she wanted me to talk to her about it. And it was a wonderful afternoon. And she was telling me a story, which I'm sure you had heard about, where in her career, Elvis Presley wanted to record her song, I Will Always Love You, that, of course, Whitney Houston had a mega hit with years later. And she went and met with Elvis, and she was thrilled that Elvis wanted to do her song. And she said that, she couldn't wait to hear Elvis sing it. And as she left the meeting with Elvis, Elvis's manager pulled her aside and said, hey, Dolly, just so you know, if Elvis is going to do your song, we get 51% or something of publishing, even though he had nothing to do with the song. And she dug in and didn't give it up. So to this day, Elvis never did the song. And she said it was one of the best decisions she ever made in her life, obviously, because later on, Whitney Houston has a huge hit and she retained publishing. I'm curious for you, as a young songwriter, as you started to get some heat on you, were you ever in situations like that where artists tried to take stuff that what they were not entitled to?
Well, you know, I had gotten a call, you know, my manager got a call, like, on the very first song I wrote with Bon Jovi, You Give Love a Bad Name. And the manager called and said, hey, you know what? We'd like to buy you out of the song. And we're willing to pay you $35,000 to walk away, take your name off. That's it. You buy out. And it was like, I was furious. I called John and I said, If your manager continues down this road, we'll never see each other again. And John, you know, to his credit, did the right thing and told, you know, his manager to knock it off. And so, you know, that's why we were able to get back together and write Living on a Prayer and, you know, all like that. And I always have insisted on being a, you know, equal writer. And it doesn't matter if one of the writers went out to get Starbucks and by the time they got back, the song was written. If, you know, write a word, get a third, you know, that's our credo. And so it all comes out in the wash that way. And so it's amazing that you mentioned Dolly Parton and her new album, Rockstar, because track number 12 is a song that I co-wrote with Joan Jett called I Hate Myself for Loving You. And
yes.
Joan is featured on that song.
Yep,
so
I
haven't heard it yet, but I'm very excited about this, because now I can add Dolly Parton to my list of, you know, superstars that recorded my music.
Yeah, she did a great version of it. I mean, I've heard the whole record because I had to get in advance because we did this whole thing that's yet to come out. But she's got 30 songs on the record and an additional 4 bonus tracks. And on most of the record, there's eight original songs, but 22 covers. And on most of the record, there are a bunch of special guests. And I know Joan is on that with her. And yeah, that look, I could talk to you forever about your songs. It's truly amazing. But I Hate Myself for Loving You is just, it's remarkable what that's turned into. Dolly covering it. And of course, a rewrite version of it has become a football anthem, as I'm sure you well know.
Yeah, Sunday Night Football. Which,
yeah.
You know,
so how does that feel?
Lyrics on that, and so
did you write those lyrics for the football version?
Yeah, they sent them to me, and I you know, was tweaking them, you know, as best as I could to fit, you know, the football theme. But I did work on that. And, you know, thank God, you know, that's the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, we had Faith Hill sing it, Pink sang it, Carrie Underwood sang it. Then she insisted on replacing it with songs she had written. And by popular demand, they made her go back to, you know, the I Hate Myself for Loving You of Joan Jett.
Yeah, no, that's really, really cool. Hey, you know, again, so much we can talk about, and I got maybe 15 minutes left, and I appreciate your time. I wanted to ask you, and I really do feel we got to do another round once I really read through the book, because I can't wait to dig in. But there's two acts that you worked with that don't come up all that often that I'm curious to get some thoughts on from you in the rock world, because, of course, that's what my show is mainly about. You did an album that I thought was really cool. I think you served as executive producer on it and had some co-writes on it by Rat. I think it was the Detonator album, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
What were your recollections about working with them at the time? Because there's a song on that record. When you talk about the songwriters, like the hottest songwriters at the time, there's a song on that record that's a co-write with yourself, Diane Warren, and Stephen Piercy, the singer in Rat, called Giving Yourself Away. That how that didn't become massive at the time, I'll never know. But what was your experience like working with Rat?
I had a great time with them. They were very respectful, and they had been having a very hard time with one of their members, King, who, you know, was really struggling with drug abuse.
Robin Crosby. Yeah.
Yeah. And he ended up, you know, passing away because of it. And, you know, I had a great time with them. And, you know, I was offered to produce it, but at that time I had my album Discipline ready to come out. And so I decided, you know, well, I can executive produce and I can write, you know, songs. I wrote a bunch of songs with them. I love, you know, Loving You Is a Dirty Job. I mean, you know,
great.
And I'm the Man to Do It. I mean, it's
great,
just
song.
So much fun. But the thing is, they were victims of the, you know, Nirvana. You know,
right.
It took one view of Smells Like Teen Spirit and all the bands I worked with got wiped off the map. You know,
I just did a whole show. I just did a whole show about that.
What?
Yeah, I called it the Great Wall of Nirvana. I just did a whole show about that, about great records that came out after the gate of Nirvana came down. We just did a whole radio special about that. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, all of the bands that I work with became, you know, legacy bands. You know, they do really well live, and also people go back to that music, like now more than ever, and realize that those songs were great, and that a lot of the shoegazer songs that, you know, people didn't really even have that much skill. You know, they maybe were art students that could play four chords and have, you know, hair in their face, and they just look straight down. It's like even the body language, you know, of the bands that I work with was like chest up, you know, and then the next generation was like chest in, look down. And so I guess that's, you know, the swings of, you know, people's taste, and, you know, times change and all of that. It's, you know, it's always bound to happen. And I really do like modern rock. You know, I mean, I love like Slipknot and all that kind of stuff that happened after that in the 90s. And, you know, I just discovered a new band that was not new, but they've been around for a while, but I never had heard of them, called Clone with a K. And
I don't know them.
Baroness. Because I went and got this huge, like, Viking tattoo in the Northern England, and that's all they played, like, on repeat for the 4 days that I was there. And it's just, like, really Nordic sounding. There's no blues in it whatsoever. And I think there's a place for every kind of music, you know, and people should be enjoying all kinds of music. When I was a kid in the projects, one kid would always have a transistor radio, and there was one station to listen to. And you'd hear, you know, the Beatles and Aretha Franklin, Dionne Warwick. You'd hear the Four Seasons. You'd hear the Everly Brothers. You'd hear Wilson Pickett. Then you'd hear, you know, James Brown. And then you'd hear, you know, Little Richard. And then you'd hear, you know, like, you know, Dusty Springfield, one song after the other. So we start to have an appreciation of all these different styles, and that's, you know, it was fantastic. So that kind of narrow thinking was marketed at the time when all of a sudden there were like 1,000 stations all playing rock. You know, it's like that kind of narrow view, I think, has hurt the culture of this country.
Well, I think it's changed. I think the way people get music now, because we grew up, of course, in a time where you went to a record store, and I worked in a record store for years, where people would come in and they'd have to make an investment and take a shot on buying a record off of one song they heard on the radio and hope the other nine songs were good. But I think now the way we are, speaking of Spotify and streaming, which is the way most people digest music, I mean, you know, my kids, I'm sure your kids, I mean, they want to hear songs in, they can click, click, click and go through anything they want and pull up anything they want in 2 seconds. And I think having that range of like, okay, I'm not making a $10 or $20 investment just to sample a record anymore has probably exposed people to not only a lot more variety, but also maybe a little more depth in artist catalogs. Although I think people still end up gravitating towards the hit when they click.
You know, my sons, they've only listened to almost exclusively urban music and rap. And so the other...
How old are they?
I mean, they're 21 years old now. So, you know, I came home and I'm hearing like this like twangy stuff. And I went back. It's like, Nero, what are you listening to? Oh, I'm really getting into country music now. It's like, What? He grew up in Nashville and, you know, hated country music. And now he loves it. I mean, it's so crazy, but they can do every rap, like word, like syllable by syllable of like the last, you know, their whole lives. And so, you know, I think it's because it's a music that I really, you know, I'm not in. So they found their own music that wasn't the stuff that daddy likes, you know, right. And the daddy writes, you know, but, you know, it really is a great thing. But at the same time, they should pay us, you know, you know, because the fact is that, you know, when we were working on trying to push through the Music Modernization Act, you know, to try to raise our rates a little bit, you know, a lot of these Congress people, they thought that we had no overhead expenses to write a song. They thought we'd just sit on a porch with a banjo on our knee and a corn pipe, and that was, you know, that was our expense, you know. And, you know, I had to explain that, you know, it's like, I have a studio, I pay rent on the studio, I'm upgrading my equipment all the time, I have to have engineers, I have to have programmers, I have to have assistants, I have to have lawyers to make my, you know, my production deals. I mean, it's like, there's hardly anything in it at the end, but you just have to do it because that's all you know how to do. You know, I don't have a B plan for music. That's for damn sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other act I wanted to hit you with real quickly that you made a record with that I thought was a really interesting record was you did some work with Scorpions. What is your recollection of working with those guys?
Well, you know, I had done Bat Outta Hell 3, which, by the way, is a masterpiece. Meatloaf, it took me 9 months to make it. And, you know, it's not that accessible in the United States, you know, because at the end he felt bad that he made the record without Jim Steinman. So he's kind of, you know, at the end, you know, because he owned the rights to the U.S. version. In Europe, it's, you know, all over. Everybody knows the record and it's on Spotify and all that. But then we had a kind of like a cast party of the 100 people that worked on Bat Outta Hell 3. I mean, it was a lot of people, and I had this party in my house, and the Scorpions showed up. And, you know, they showed up, and they were like cowboy hats, gold chains, leopard shirts, you know, like ripped jeans and cowboy boots, right? They're from Germany. Right. And they said, oh, you know, we want you to, you know, produce our next record. So, and so I like the challenge of it, because I always loved the Scorpions. And so I put together a team of songwriters, and we collaborated and made this record that had a very strong theme that's now more relevant than ever, called Humanity Hour One.
Right.
And it was, all the songs were about the battle between AI and robotics and human beings and soul. And so every song, it's almost like a theatrical piece. And, you know, at the end, there's this epic song called Humanity. And, you know, it's got all of that kind of like authoritarian sound to it. You know, it's like, you know, it's just so great. And one of my kids, Roman, at the end of it, he says, it's time. And he has this little scratchy voice. And so the thing is that I don't think they actually understood the record they made with me. they didn't understand the epic scope of it. And, right. You know, at that time, their manager was, you know, just having them play like, you know, Schlagerfelds, you know, like beer halls and stuff. and I mean, I wanted to transport them. And so I got them in styled like they were like European art band, like more like U2. And then we had this Liam Call. He was a futurist that did all this animated stuff or like where he took, you know, these beautiful models and gave them like rip skin and you could see the robotics inside and everything. And they were in bunkers and there was fire and flames and there was all this kind of stuff like it was the end of the world. And it's more relevant now than ever. It's yeah. unbelievable. So sometimes yeah. you get a little bit ahead of your time.
Desmond, two quick things and I'll let you go because I'm going to have to wrap here in a second. Throughout your career, most of the songwriting you've done has been collaborations, whether it's, you know, with Paul Stanley, with, you know, with John and Richie, of course, for Bon Jovi, whoever it may be, you know, there's been most of the stuff has been collaborative. Is that your preference to work that way? Or have you written a lot of songs where you are the sole songwriter?
Well, when I had my group, Desmond Child and Rouge, I mean, have, because we're still working together and making music, I was basically solo writing, and then, you know, I do an occasional co-write with either Maria Vidal, you know, who's the original Gina of Tommy and Gina, and then once I got into co-writing with Paul Stanley and other bands started calling, it was the path of least resistance, because when I did write a song that wasn't with an artist, I wasn't getting cuts. So the secret weapon was write with the band, you know, write with the main, you know, like the main singer and the lead guitar player, because that's the person that usually says, I don't like the song. So if you write with both of those two people, usually the rest of the band falls in with it. And so it was a survival technique. You know, I really don't enjoy being alone. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. I had a lonely childhood. So I love the sandbox with friends, and I love the laughter and the jokes and the gossip. You know, when you're sitting there kind of all gloomy and your hands on a piano trying to write what's in your heart, I don't know. That doesn't sound like fun to me. But I did write a song on my own called Lady Liberty, which I wrote for Barbara Streisand, and she and I co-produced it on her last studio album called Walls. And, you know, if you go and watch the video, the lyric video of Lady Liberty, I mean, it's stunning. And, you know, she sang like she was 20 years old. I mean, she sang just all those big notes, and she put her heart into it because it was something that she was feeling deeply. You know, and it was a tribute to the Statue of Liberty and to freedom and to, you know, the importance of our country representing, you know, being the beacon through the golden door for opportunity from people all over the world. And, you know, all of a sudden the Statue of Liberty, you know, was getting deported. Somebody even said we should give her back to France because she was inviting immigrants into the country. I swear to God, a congressman was trying to put a bill through that was like, we're done with her. She's a woman. She's inviting immigrants. What the heck, you know? Send her back to France. like the ultimate symbol of liberty. She's even called the Statue of Liberty. And so this song is stunning. And, you know, I've been working on a Broadway show called Cuba Libre. And it's the true story of my family before and after the Cuban Revolution. And that's really a huge, you know, goal for me, is to get on Broadway somehow, some way. And this work has been going on since 2005. We've had all these different directors. We've done all these workshops. We have a new director, a new producer. We're getting ready to do a workshop in New York City in the first week of December, and backers auditions and all that. We're back in the saddle on that. And so, you know, the thing is, it's like, you know, when you're writing a song like Living Our Prayer, that's cinematic in its own way. It's 4 minutes. But when you write a 2-hour piece with all these interconnecting stories and beautiful themes and all that, when you walk in the entrance, you're one person. When they push you out the exit in the other side of the building, you're transformed. And that, to me, is a great, great thing to reach for. And so I've been doing that, and you know, of course, you know, promoting my book, Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life, because, you know, well, actually, I had a bunch of big songs, but my life's bigger than my songs, you know, and that's kind of, like, scary, right? And and also, I have a skincare line, that, you know, because somebody told me if you're a celebrity, you have to have a skincare line. So I created one called Vida Loca Skincare. Wait, VidaLocaSkinLife.com. And so it's, you know, our slogan is skin has no gender.
Okay.
You know, and it's kind of like one of those things. It's like all natural and all this, because I always loved my mom's, like, little lotions and potions I wasn't allowed to touch, you know, and the smell of them and all that. So, you know, people make fun of me because when I travel, I have, like, 2 suitcases of all my lotions and potions, you know, when I travel. It's like, Daddy.
You're a nightmare going through TSA. They're like, you're way over the 2-ounce limit. Desmond, you got
to
go back.
No. I have to put them through luggage. You know, it's like,
right.
But, you know, I'm trying to do all these fun things now, because when else am I going to do them?
Yeah. And, hey, man, I don't mean to cut you off, but I have to, because I got a hard ending here. But
yes,
it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for all the great music. The book is out now, Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life. And we absolutely have to do another round when I get a chance to dig through the book a little bit more.
Please call
me
back.
I will. Congratulations on everything, man, and I can't
wait
to talk to you again. All right. See you, Desmond. Bye-bye. Always great to talk to Desmond, and I'll tell you what, I could spend hours talking to that guy, because his catalog is absolutely amazing as far as the songs that he has been a part of. Unfortunately, I've not had the time to read that book in its entirety, but I look forward to doing so soon and getting into more of those stories, maybe even do another interview with him at some point in the future. Thanks for listening to the podcast, everybody. Again, if you don't have SiriusXM Radio, you can try it for free for 3 months, no credit card required. All you got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk, get that 3-month free trial subscription, and listen to the radio show each and every day. It's live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern, noon to 2 Pacific, Faction Talk, Channel 103, or anytime, full shows and interviews, audio, video, and more on the SiriusXM app. And again, follow on social media at Eddie Trunk, X, Instagram, or the Facebook page for info and updates on everything I have going on in the world of rock. Next appearance, if you happen to be in Tulsa, I'll be there this coming Friday at the Graffiti Lounge with John Karabi. Keep an eye on my socials for info and updates. If you're on the radio side of things, you can absolutely get ready for a Power Trip special that was recorded at the recent Power Trip. That'll be airing on my radio show soon, and that features interviews with members of Iron Maiden, Guns N' Roses, Duff McKagan, as I mentioned, from Guns, Nico McBrain from Maiden, Ian Hill and Richie Faulkner of Judas Priest, Lars Ulrich of Metallica, Chris Robinson of the Black Crows, Scotty Hill from Skid Row, some folks that were just hanging out. So get ready for that special coming soon to the radio show on SiriusXM Radio. We'll see if we can bring it to you as a podcast somewhere down the line. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. Hope you catch me on the radio. If not, I'll catch you back here next Thursday for another podcast.
Rack your look for spring at Nordstrom Rack and save up to 60% on brands you love. Rag & Bone, Vince, Marc Jacobs, Adidas, Joe's, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Score new dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and sunglasses, plus updates for the family and home. Get your spring on for less, up to 60% less, today at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.